He stood up and went to the steel trap, lying at the end of its chain. The severed leg was still held between the relentless jaws, and Mark squatted to examine it. The trap was the type they call a slagæster, a killing iron, and the spikes of the jaws had been carefully filed to bite but not sever. It weighed at least 30 pounds, and it would take a thick branch to lever those jaws open and reset the mechanism. The steel was dark and sooty where the poacher had scorched it with a torch of dry grass to kill the man-smell on the metal. Lying at the edge of the thicket was the half-decomposed carcass of a baboon, the odoriferous bait which had been irresistible to the big yellow cat. Mark reloaded the Mannlicher, and his anger was so intense that he would have shot down the man who had done this thing if he had come across him at that moment, despite the fact that he owed him his life. He walked back up the slope and unsaddled Trojan, hobbled him with the leather straps, and hung his saddlebags in the branches of the leadwood, out of the way of a questing hyena or badger. Then he went back and picked up the poacher's spoor at the edge of the thicket. He knew it would be useless to follow on the mule. The poacher would be alerted at a mile range by that big clumsy animal, but he had a chance on foot. The spoor was fresh, and the poacher's camp would be close. He would not stray far from such a valuable asset as his steel trap. Mark had a very good chance. He would be cagey, of course, sly and cunning, for he would know that it was now forbidden to hunt in the valley. Mark had visited each village, spoken with each tribal headman, and drank his beer while he explained to him the new order. The poacher knew that he was outside the law. Mark had followed his spoor so often, and the precautions Pungushi took, the elaborate ruses to throw any pursuit, made it clear that he was in guilt. But now Mark had a good chance at him. The spoor crossed the river half a mile downstream, and then started to zigzag back and forth among the scrub, forest and brush as the poacher visited his trap line. The leopard trap was clearly the centre of his line, but he was noosing for small game, using light galvanised baling wire, probably purchased for a few shillings at a country general dealer's store. He was also using copper telegraph wire, probably obtained by blatantly scaling a telegraph pole in some lonely place. He was trapping for jackal, baiting with offal, and he was trapping indiscriminately at salt licks and mud wallows, any place that might attract small game. Following the trap line diligently, Mark sprang every wire noose and ripped it out. He closed rapidly with his quarry, but it was 3 hours before he found the poacher's camp. It was under the swollen, bloated, reptilian grey branches of a baobab tree. The tree was old and rotten, its huge trunk cleaved by a deep hollow, a cave that the poacher had used to shield his small smokeless cooking fire. The fire was dead now, carefully smothered with sand, but the smell of dead smoke led Mark to it. The ashes were cold. Tucked away in the deepest recess of the hollow tree were two bundles tied with plaited bark string. One bundle held a greasy grey blanket, a carved wooden headrest, a small black three-legged pot, and a pouch of impala skin, which contained 2 or 3 pounds of yellow maize and strips of dried meat. The poacher travelled light and moved fast. The other bundle contained 15 jackal skins, sun-dried and crackling stiff, beautiful furs of silver and black and red, and 2 leopard skins, a big dark golden tom and a smaller half-grown female. Mark relit the fire and threw the blanket, the headrest, and the bag upon it, deriving a thin vindictive satisfaction as they smouldered and blackened. He smashed the iron pot with a rock, and then he slung the roll of dried skins on his shoulder and started back. It was almost dark when he got back to the leopard thicket beside the river. He dropped the heavy bundle of dried skin, which by this time felt like a 100-weight sack of coal on his shoulder, and stared uncomprehendingly at the leopard's carcass. It swarmed with big green metallic shiny flies. They were laying their eggs on the dead flesh like bunches of white boiled rice, but what astonished Mark was that the carcass was naked. It had been expertly stripped of its golden fur, and now it was a raw pink, laced with yellow fat and the white tracery of muscle ligaments. The head was bare, the mask stripped away, so that dull, startled eyes stared out of the skull like marbles, and tufts of black hair sprang from the open ear holes. The fangs were exposed in a fixed yellow grin. Quickly, Mark ran to the anchor log. The chain and trap were gone. It was fully a minute before the next logical step occurred to him. He ran up the slope to the leadwood tree. Trojan was gone. The hobbling straps had been cut with a razor-sharp blade and laid out neatly under the leadwood tree. Trojan, unexpectedly relieved of his hobble, had reacted gratefully in a fully predictable manner. He had set off, arrow straight through the forest, back home to his rude stable, his nightly ration of grain, and the congenial company of his old buddy Spartan. It was a 15-mile walk back to main camp, and it would be dark in 15 minutes. The saddlebags had been taken down from the tree and the contents meticulously picked over. What Pungushi had rejected, he had folded and stacked neatly on a flat rock. He clearly did not think much of William Shakespeare. His tragedies had been put aside, and he had left Mark his chamois hunting jacket, a last-minute gift from Ruth Courtney. He had taken the gentleman's sleeping bag, which had once belonged to General Courtney, with its built-in ground sheet and genuine eider filling, 25 guineas worth from Harrods of London, good exchange for a threadbare greasy blanket and wooden headrest. He had taken the cooking pot, pannikin and cutlery, the salt and flour and bully beef, but he had left a single tin of beans. He had taken the clean shirt and khaki trousers, but had left the spare woollen socks and rubber-soled boots. Perhaps it was a chance that the boots pointed downstream, to Mark's camp. Or was it mockery? A can of beans and boots to carry Mark home. Through the red mists of his humiliation and mounting rage, Mark glimpsed suddenly a whimsical sense of humour at work. The man had been watching him. Mark was sure of that now. His selection from the saddlebags echoed too faithfully what Mark had burned of his. In his imagination, Mark heard the deep bell of Zulu laughter, and he snatched up the manlika and picked up Pungushi's outgoing spoor. He followed it for only 100 yards and then stopped. Pungushi was heavily laden with trap, wet skin and booty, but he had hit the Zulu's stride Minza Amhlabati, and he was eating ground to the north at a pace which Mark knew was pointless to try and imitate. He walked back to the leadwood tree and sank down beside the trunk. His rage turned to acute discomfort at the thought of the 15-mile walk home, carrying the saddlebags and the roll of dried skins, for honour dictated he did not abandon his meagre spoils. Suddenly he began to laugh, a helpless, hopeless shaking of his shoulders, and he laughed until tears ran down his cheeks and his belly ached. Pungushi! I'll get even for this, he promised weakly through his laughter. It rained after midnight, a quick hard downpour, just enough to soak Mark and to bower the grass with clinging drops. Then a small chill wind came nagging like an old wife, and the wet grass soaked his boots until they squelched and chafed with each step, and his cigarettes had disintegrated into a yellow porridge of mangled tobacco and limp rice paper, and the roll of skin and the saddle and the bags cut into his shoulders, and he did not laugh again that night. In the pre-dawn, the cliffs of Sharker's Gate were purple and milky smooth, flaming suddenly with the sun's ardent kiss in vivid rose and bronze, but Mark plodded on under his burden, tired beyond any appreciation of beauty, beyond feeling or even caring, until he came out of the forest onto the bank of the Bubezi River and stopped in mid-stride. He sniffed in total disbelief and was immediately assailed by the demands of his body, the quick flood of saliva from under his tongue and the cramping of his empty belly. It was the most beautiful odour he had ever smelled, bacon frying and eggs in the pan, slowly gelling and firming in the sizzling fat. He knew it was only a figment of his exhaustion, for he had eaten his last bacon 6 weeks before. Then his ears played tricks also. He heard the ring of an axe blade on wood, and the faint melody of Zulu voices, and he lifted his head and stared ahead through the forest into his old camp below the wild figs. There was a cone of pristine white canvas, an officer's bell tent, recently pitched beside his own rudely thatched lean-to shelter. The campfire had been built up, and Chlubi, the old Zulu cook, was busy with his pans over it, while beyond the flames in a collapsible canvas camp chair, sitting comfortably, was the burly figure of General Courtney, watching his breakfast cook with a critical eye. He looked up and saw Mark, bedraggled and dirty as an urchin at the edge of the camp, and his grin was wide and boyish. "Chlubi," he said in Zulu, "another 4 eggs and a pound of bacon." Sean Courtney's vast energy and enthusiasm were the beacon flames that made the next week one of the memorable interludes in Mark's life. He would always remember him as he was in those days, belly laughing at Mark's tale of woe and frustration with Pungushi, and then, still chuckling, calling to his servants and repeating the story to them, with his own comments and embellishments, until they rocked and reeled with mirth, and old fat Chlubi overturned a pan of eggs, his great paunch bouncing like a ball, and his cannonball of a head, with its hoar-frosting of pure white wool, rolling uncontrollably from side to side. Mark, half-starved on a diet of bully and beans, gorged himself on the miraculous food that flowed from Chlubi's spade-sized, pink-palmed hands. He was amazed at the style in which Sean Courtney braved the hardships of the African bush. From his full-sized hip bath to the portable kerosene-burning icebox that delivered endless streams of frothing cold beer against the stunning heat of midday. "Why travel in steerage when you can go first class?" Sean asked, and winked at Mark as he spread a large-scale map of northern Zululand on the camp table. "Now, what have you got to tell me?" Their discussions lasted late into each night, with a Petromax hissing in the tree overhead and the jackals yipping and piping along the river, and in the days they rode the ground. Sean Courtney up on Spartan, so clearly enjoying every moment of it, with the vitality of a man half his age, keeping going without a check even in the numbing heat of noon, inspecting the site that Mark had chosen for the main camp, arguing as to where the Bubezi Bridge should be built, following the road through the forest where Mark had blazed the trees, exulting at the sight of a big black Nyala ram, with his heavy mane and ghostly stripes, as it raced away panic-stricken by the approach of a man. Sitting in his hip bath under the fig trees, up to his waist in creaming white suds, with a cigar in his mouth and a long glass of beer in his hand, bellowing for Chlubi to top up with boiling water from the big kettle when his bath cooled. Big and scarred and hairy. And Mark realized then what a wide space this man had filled in his life. As the day drew closer, when he must leave again, Sean's mood changed, and in the evenings he brooded over the list of animals that Mark had compiled. 50 zebra, he read Mark's estimate, and poured the last few inches of whiskey from the pinch bottle into his glass. "On the Sabi River in 95, a single herd crossed in front of my wagons. It took 40 minutes at the gallop to go by, and the leaders were over the horizon when the tail passed us. There were 30,000 animals in that one herd." "No elephant?" he asked, looking up from the list, and when Mark shook his head, he went on softly, "We thought it would last forever. In 99, when I rode into Pretoria from the north, I had 10 tons of ivory on board. 10 tons! 20,000 pounds of ivory." "No lions there?" And again Mark shook his head. "I don't think so, General. I've seen no sign of them, nor heard them in the night. But when I was a boy, I shot one near here. I was with my grandfather." "Yes," Sean nodded, "when you were a boy. But what about your son, Mark? Will he ever see a lion in the wild?" Mark did not answer, and Sean grunted. "No lions on the Bubezi River. God, what have we done to this land?" He stared into the fire. "I wonder if it was mere chance that you and I met, Mark. You've opened my eyes and conscience. It was I and men like me that did this." He shook that great shaggy head, and groped in the side pocket of his baggy hunting jacket, and produced a leather-bound, pocket-sized book, a thick little volume, well-thumbed and shiny with the grease of grubby hands.